so.
Right, right. Is it up to 5.5? Right, yeah. So
how are you?
In fact, we just put that hard number in law a few years ago.
Ready? And I was saying, that bill
that, that went to 5.5? Was it that long?
Good afternoon, and welcome to this joint hearing of Environment and Energy and Natural Resources Budget Division, Subcommittee on Natural Resources, and E-12 Education Budget Committee. It is the Wednesday the 29th. It's approximately 1:10. We're in room 123. The hearing, this is, of course, the second in a series of hearings on school trust lands and the management thereof. And, of course, a little review will tell us that much of this came about because of a piece of legislation that was passed last year, authored in the Senate by Senator Lynch, which actually said that any income that came out of the school trust fund, interest that was going to go into education, would supplant the general fund money that was already there. So this has kind of thrown a little bit of a change into what our strategy is. But along with that, I think we note that school trust funds over the years haven't been particularly valuable in terms of what they've derived from royalties in terms of minerals, and now we have some non-ferrous mining projects which are up for permitting, and in fact could produce a substantial amount of income for the school trust fund, and the uses of the forests and the more intensive use of at least school trust lands and the derivation of some more income off of that is a real possibility, that given the energy of the biomass, cellulosic biofuels, and that whole gamut. I've got old business down there on the agenda for number two, and what I'd like to do is, although there's no formal presentation, I'd like to ask Mr. Vadas of minerals of the DNR maybe to at least be available here if anybody has a question. Senator Scogin, you said you might have a question for him.
Well, I just thought for some thank you, Mr. Chair, for some clarification. You know, I think the last time we got together, we talked a little bit about University of Minnesota trust lands and public school trust lands, and if I could get some clarification on percentage of those two, or the difference between those two, or which one's generating real dollars and which one's not, or what the difference might be between.
Marty, could you step up there? I think the question is kind of with what I was talking about there. Non-ferrous mining is on the school trust lands, and we've heard for so many years about the university trust lands their value, and the value is what? That most of them are on the Iron Range, or?
Good afternoon. My name is Marty Vadas, and I'm the Director of Lands and Minerals Division for the Department of Natural Resources. And Mr. Chair, members, both of those classes of land are lands that came to Minnesota's ownership through the federal government when Minnesota became a state. One is the University Trust, and that was deeded to the state for the support of the university. And the other is the school trust lands, which we've talked about so much. And the purpose of those lands was to support K through 12 education throughout the state. So they're two separate, distinct transfers of land to Minnesota ownership from the federal government for those two specific purposes. Minnesota originally received about on the order of in total 8 million acres of school trust land, and today there's about 2.5 million acres of that land remaining in state ownership. The rest has been sold, and an additional 1 million acres of severed mineral rights. So in total, today there's 2.5 million acres of surface and 3.5 million acres of mineral rights for school trust land. The university trust land, it was a much smaller original grant to the state, and if my memory is right, today there's on the order of, I believe it's about 20,000 acres of surfaced an additional 20,000 of severed minerals. It's on that order of magnitude. Those probably aren't the exact right numbers, but it's in that order.
But and Mr. Chair, a follow-up. Yeah, but the university trust land, am I correct that that has generated a lot more money over the years?
Mr. Chairman, that would not be accurate. School trust lands have generated more income than the university trust lands. It is true in the last few years there's been a great deal of mining, taconite mining on some of the university trust lands. Mm-hmm. Originally there was a large pit over at a company called LTV on the eastern end of the range, and that was almost wholly owned by the university trust. And most recently the mining that's taken place at Keewatin Taconite, which is on the west end of the range, that land also is substantially all university trust land. So there were many years where that land was not mined, but just in the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a higher than amount of mining on university trust land because it's happened to be in the right location as the mining was taking place. The university trust land at Keewatin Taconite, for example, more than half of that ore has been mined, and so while it continues to generate revenue, the amount of tons will go down in future years just because the ore is being exhausted in that particular location.
Other questions before we leave mining? Thank you. I appreciate your time. Next on our agenda, we have Howard Bicker, Executive Director of the State Board of Investments, and he's going to give us a little short presentation on the investments and return to the school trust fund. Everybody have their – you should have a
– It's coming.
Oh, it's being handed out right now. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Howard Bicker. I'm the Director of the State Investment Board. Provide you a little handout as it relates to the permanent school fund. The state board is responsible for the investment of the proceeds from the lands in the permanent school fund. As of June 30th, this was approximately $690 million. The portfolio is basically a balanced portfolio of 50% domestic stocks and 50% domestic bonds. This is a change that was implemented through discussions with both the administration and the legislature in 1997. Prior to that, the majority of the permanent school fund was just invested in bonds, and the basic thought process was to make this fund more of an endowment-type fund so that if you don't grow the principal, the income stream will remain constant. So if you earn $100 million 1 year and 10 years later you're still earning $100 million, it's not the same amount of money. So what we wanted to do is be able to grow the principal of the fund, and the principal of the fund is inviolate. In other words, it cannot use the principal of the fund for expenditures, only the income. So if we grow the principal of the fund, which was, you know, say it's $100 million income 1 year, hopefully it's 110 a couple years later, and 120, and so on and so forth, so that we can make the income stream of the permanent school a real income stream instead of a diminishing income stream. You can see how the fund is done over the years. On the second page is some of the returns. Obviously, this year has been a lot of fun for everybody. The markets have not been very conducive to a lot of things, but hopefully the permanent school fund, like the pension funds and whatnot, are very long-term oriented investors. You can see going back to fiscal 2004, you can see the spendable income, and it has grown on an annual basis, and that's the goal, is to kind of maintain a real income stream. So, Mr. Chairman and members, that's a very brief review of the permanent school fund. If anybody wants more detail or just some questions, I'd gladly respond.
Questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Bicker, I guess just out of curiosity, how does this fund perform compared to other funds that the state may manage or funds that, I mean, what is the benchmark? What is the comparative that we ought to be looking at? I think one of the questions that we've had as a committee or a subcommittee is what should the expectations be of the performance of the school trust fund? And so can you make any comment in terms of that and how we might answer that, whether this is adequate, whether this is superlative, whether it's in the ballpark? Can you give us some help on evaluating that?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator, as far as our performance, we have we established a bogey. In other words, if we were to passively manage this, how we've done versus us. You can see on the second page that on an annualized basis, in the right-hand columns, the three-year, our fund has returned 4.6, the bogey is 4.4, 5 years, 6.1 versus 5.8, 10 years, 7.4 versus 6.1. So, and this is net of all costs and expenses, so we have actually outperformed our bogey. Now, this fund will have a different return than the pension assets, for example, in the sense that the pension assets actually have some more long-term investments in what we call alternative investments, private equity, venture capital, those types of things, which are not necessarily appropriate for this kind of fund because of the inviolate nature of the principal. So there will be difference in the returns for this fund versus the retirement-related assets. But we also have a kind of standard, quote-unquote, return in the sense that we have at least 50% of the portfolio in equities. So we expect to have a real rate of return over long periods of time. So our return versus inflation should be positive, which hopefully will also grow the income stream.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Ann. Senator Ann.
Now, you're responsible to take the monies that are generated by the asset and invest those monies. And so what you're reporting on is the performance, I guess, of that investment activity.
That's correct.
And I think another question that we've had as a committee has been the performance of the asset base itself. And is that anything that you're able to comment on in terms of we have X number of dollars in the asset base. It's yielding a certain amount of money to be invested. Any comment on that performance or that? Is there any expectations that we ought to have, or what would you say in respect to that?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator, as far as the revenue derived from the underlying land and the permanent school fund, that is outside my expertise. I will yield to DNR or whoever is responsible for the various pieces of.
And Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Ann.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Bicker. I'm not trying to put you in a position of answering questions you're not supposed to be responsible to answer. But in your experience in dealing with this or maybe other kinds of things, is there a way to make a reasonable comparison? If part of the question that we have is how does this thing perform, what is a reasonable way to assess that? And that's one of the questions we're wrestling with. And do you have any suggestions for us or comment on how what should the expectations be? There have been some who felt that this has not done as well as it should. Others think it's doing as well as it ought. I'm just trying to get a sense of where we ought to look to in terms of expectations.
Well, Mr. Chairman, sir, resources as a quote-unquote asset class used to be a pretty stable type environment. It's far from stable these days. You've seen a lot of people who have invested huge sums of money in commodities because they thought they were going to be brilliant. And everybody gets really smart when things go up. Those people aren't so smart today. Copper used to be $4.50. It's now $1.90. Oil was $147. It's, $67 or something today. And how you translate that into, timber and iron ore, there has been some institutional funds that have done stuff in timber. But the reality is most of those people, and I shouldn't say this out loud, but again, it shows you everybody isn't always that bright, a lot of timber funds made money because they happened to be close to towns. And when everybody was expanding, they basically bought their timber for a housing development and made money on the housing instead of on the timber. There really is very little of any institutional, as far as pension stuff goes, as relates to metals.
Okay. Senator Boniff.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Bicker, hello.
Senator.
I'm wondering, when I look at the loss here, it looks like 2008 minus 3%, which is actually comparatively pretty good given how the rest of the market has performed. But
unfortunately,
then,
it's true.
But, yeah. But then it occurs to me that that's probably through the June quarter. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, this is through June.
Yeah. So do you have any insight as to what we might be looking at if we were looking at through September?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ivanov, we're probably, and again, I mean, the market was up 11% yesterday. I mean, these numbers move around pretty. So far this fiscal year, the Perma School Fund is probably down high single digits. I would guess 7-8%, something like that for the fiscal year.
Which, again, comparatively, is not so bad.
Actually, it's doing relatively well versus, I mean, if you had, and pension plans, in other words, have exposure to a lot of international investments, and some of our retirement-related assets do, and they've gotten just, you know, they've had a very tough go of it because not only has the market's gone down, but the euro's gone from 160 to 125, so they've taken that additional hit. So if you take the performance of the Permanent School Fund over the last year or so through today, although it may not be pretty, it's probably actually very good on a relative
I think
basis.
I would take it. Thank you.
Other guys, Senator Ann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Vicker, sorry, I wanted to ask another question here. That, you mentioned earlier that originally the idea with this investment was to preserve the principal and it would yield, if we did that, roughly a flat return. And then there was a change in strategy, say we want to grow the revenue stream, and so we want to expand the principal. And does that strategy imply the assumption of a larger element of risk in the management strategy that you're employing? In other words, what kind of – if you were going to describe the approach that you're taking to this investment is it high risk, low risk? I mean, are you? I get it that you're not focused entirely on just preserving the principal, but there is a strong element of that. So, how would you describe that to us in terms of this management of these funds?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hamm, if you're going to try to grow the principal, there is implied some additional level of risk and some level of risk in the sense of volatility of returns. When you're dealing with the stock market, you have somewhat more volatility than historically the bond market, although over the last year or so, that has not necessarily also been true. But that is the decision you have to reach if you're going to try to grow the income stream on a real basis. It's not a free lunch. And so you have to take some additional degree of risk and volatility. Although we have 50% in U.S. stocks in this portfolio, when, again, if you look at endowments or pension funds or whatever, it's still a relatively low risk of exposure.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Senator Ann.
Thank you. And Mr. Bicker, who is responsible for determining the level of risk that these investments are going to assume? Is that something that you and the board do entirely on your own judgment? Is there a policy that you've adopted that would outline parameters for the kinds of investments that may or may not be included in the, I mean, or how what is the mechanism that this is done by?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hamm, each one of the investment portfolios that the State Board of Investment runs, and we run a number of them, are our responsibility to establish long-term policies.
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hamm.
And Mr. Bicker, are there policies then in writing in terms of how the risk and the management of these funds that the board has when in dealing with it, or is this sort of institutionalized and informal?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, they're all in writing.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Roseland.
Thank you. If we are collecting revenue for schools off of this and it fluctuates, if the revenues from the fund fluctuate a lot, how will we budget for that? I'm just wondering, you know, if we're expecting to give the school districts X amount of money, or is it always going to be whatever the income is off of the fund? They won't know. We won't know. How do you budget for something like that? I don't know if anybody has any idea.
I was going to say, Senator, is that rhetorical? Or?
Well, maybe there's somebody here who has done this in the past, because obviously some years we've had greater income off of it than others because of what the markets are doing. And I'm assuming that we're going to have lower income now, maybe not much at all, maybe none. So then what happens?
So, Mr. Bigger, can you... Are you going to answer that, or Senator Olson, are you going to answer it?
Yeah, I was going to.
Okay, Senator
Olson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Roebling, up until this year in the law that we passed, what we received from it just was reduced the general fund amount that went into the basic formula. But we separated it out this year so that it is outside of the basic formula. And so we'll be distributed equally, I think, per student to the schools. So it was our budget problem before. Now it's going to be the locals, because they'll have to wait and see what they are going to get and how they want to use that. And I think the idea was that it wouldn't be just for the basic things, but they could use it for things that were important to enhance their educational programs.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Senator Gould.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you could answer this, or maybe Mr. Bicker could. But, you know, when you talk about not using the principal, when the market erodes the principal, does that amount have to be made up before anything is available or not?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, the way it works is the principal is inviolate, and if there's a loss of principal, that principal must be made up. But it's made up through capital gains on the other side. Mm-hmm. So it's amortized over the law. You know, you sell a bond that has 10 years left, and you lose $10,000. Well, you amortize $1,000 a year over a 10-year period. So there's an accounting mechanism then to smooth this out so it isn't a big lump once I'm You know, the reality is, as far as, you know, if you have a real good year or a real bad year, that's all that is moves money into principal. It doesn't give you more spendable income. It gives us the opportunity to invest more money and hopefully earn for you. But, you know, if the stock market's down as it is right now, the income you can spend off of stocks is through dividends, because you can't spend off of principal. Now, the reality is we still own... If we own 10,000 shares of something at 50, we still own 10,000 shares at 30. And if their dividend was $1 a share, they're still, assuming they're not reducing their dividends, your income stream is still the same, because we're still getting a dollar per share. It's just the value of
it. Senator Ferrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bicker, just so it's clear to me, in this fund, it's the actual income that's earned on the corpus of the fund that's paid out. And that is different than Environmental Trust Fund, where 5.5% of the value of the fund is available for expenditure.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, you're absolutely correct.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And after what we did with the pension funds in the last session, where we used to let them use that income and give big increases whenever there were big increases available, and then if there weren't, we were still having to pay the same amount, because it was hard to go back and say, sorry, we can't give you that much this year, and we know you're counting on it. So we had problems with that. And now we've kind of stabilized that and said we're going to give more of a consistent amount every year. We're not going to see spikes like we did in the past. When we passed that law last year, did we put anything in that we'd hold back, and so that instead of having spikes, that we would have more of a steady revenue stream, perhaps, similar to like what we did with the pension funds this year? Because it really gave those other funds a roller coaster ride before, and I'd hate to see the school districts go through the same thing.
Senator Olson? Do you have an answer on that, or should we just we'll try to get that answer? I think, but it's certainly worthy of an answer when we're trying to plan.
Mr. Chairman, the difference,
Senator Olson.
I think it wasn't expected that we were rolling it into the base. That the challenge with the pension funds is that they had an increased percentage which rolled into their base for the next year, the percentage on top of that. So we are committed not only to the expanded base with a lowered value to pay out, rather than moderating that. And that's if we finally have, I think, set, as you said, set a moderate view so that, if there's money beyond that, it can help to build the fund and get us out of the liability that we've created for ourselves by our past practice in that.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
But I don't this isn't functioning that same way with the schools. In fact, we're just testing the waters by getting it separated from just rolling in and being invisible. We haven't paid much attention to the Permanent School Trust Fund because the income from it just went into the state's share of what was paid for schools. Now I think there's more attention being paid. What is it that we are getting? What kind of return are we getting on these lands and the income from it? And then how can we convey it to schools in ways that they too will understand what it is and be able to use it in some meaningful ways?
Follow up, Senator Roebling.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just worried about the expectations that might become established. And, you know, if one year they get $80 per pupil and one year they get $150 per pupil and then we have a bad year where our investments are not good and we get nothing. Mm-hmm. And they're expecting that from us. And I could see them saying, well, now the state's cut our funding again, even though this is an independent fund that they shouldn't count on in their base budgets either. I'm afraid that that could become the practice.
Mr. And, Senator Bonner, if you'll tell that to Senator Stumpf, won't you? And that's something you can study that we'll be studying this year?
Yes, and Senator Roebling, Mr. Chair, I just want to remind you that it didn't end up in the final bill that this change happened right away, that in the final negotiations we were waiting 2 years before we were going to stop the subtraction. And so I think this year, given it's a finance year, is a good year to discuss that and discuss how we really do want to use these funds and how we can plan for the ups and downs. So I think we have time.
Mr. Chair, it's also a kind of a welcome to the real world. Everybody has ups and downs, and so I think our school people, if they're preparing young people for the real world, they should have some elements of that uncertainty to have to cope with too.
Okay, other questions for Mr. Bickers? No, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
We have the Department of Natural Resources, and what we're going to talk about today is forest management on the trust lands in Minnesota. And with us today is Dave Epperle, Director of Department of Natural Resources, Department of Forestry, and the State Forester. And Mr. Epperle has an impressive background. I worked with him, of course, for years when he was in private industry, but also as the land commissioner of the largest tax forfeit, largest group of tax forfeit lands. Certainly in Minnesota, maybe in the United States, in St. Louis County, and you did an impressive job there. And let's talk about forest management on our school trust lands.
Thank you, Senator. Senators, thank you for. It's a pleasure to be here today, and good afternoon. As Senator Soxhog said, I am Dave Epperle. I'm the Director of Forestry for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And I'm going to talk to you today about forest management on school trust lands. By way of background, I'm not a long-term DNR employee. I'm pleased to say that my third year anniversary comes up on Saturday, November 1st. And even though it's 3 years, it seems like 3 weeks. We've gone through a lot, particularly in the field of forestry. And a lot of things have come and gone and are ongoing. I've been a forester for nearly 30 years, and as Senator Soxhog said, my most recent experience prior to my directorship was with St. Louis County. I served there as both deputy land commissioner and land commissioner. St. Louis County is blessed with having the largest county tax forfeited forest management program in the world, I guess we could say, just under 1 million acres, about 900,000 acres. and it has a lot of opportunity to generate income. I was there for nearly 8 years and was quite an experience. Prior to that, I was also administrator of a large county forest in Wisconsin, the Douglas County Forest, just south of Superior in Douglas County, northwest Wisconsin, was the largest county administered forest in Wisconsin at just slightly over 267,000 acres. And prior to that, my county service, which has been almost half of my career, I was with Mosny Paper Corporation. I left there as assistant manager, and I was their contract and private land forester for the corporation for nearly 8 years throughout the 80s. That was a very interesting tour of duty, and that was also in northwest Wisconsin. Their 85,000 acres are located near Solon Springs and in Washburn, Douglas, and Bayfield counties, some in Sawyer County. I'm a 1979 graduate of Michigan Technological University, so I consider myself a hybrid, but I think the experience that I gained in working in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota in both the field side of forestry, half my career in the field and half my career in administration, has really served well and has given me a very unique perspective. And being here with the Division of Forestry is an honor to be with the Minnesota DNR and overseeing some of the forest management on school trust lands. So as I said, I'm going to talk about forest management on school trust lands and some of the key points that I would like to have you just keep in mind as we talk about this, because these are important concepts of forest management. Active forest management is especially management related to investments and revenue is a dynamic process. And the generating capability or the revenue that is generated from these lands via active sustainable forest management requires investments over decades. Less than 2% of the trust fund lands are harvested in any given year. Although less than 2% of these lands generate revenue through timber harvest and those kinds of incomes, a large number of acres need silvicultural treatments, insect and pest control, and fire protection as investments to protect future revenue-generating capabilities. Sustaining attractive returns to the trust via good forest management requires investments over many acres each year that pay off as timber revenues on a few acres each year. The trust fund and other lands managed by the DNR are just under 5 million acres, but 2.5 million acres of those are the associated school trust lands. Of those 2.5 million acres that are administered by the DNR, 1.6 million acres of those are productive lands, and under today's definition of productive are those lands that are capable of producing commercial quantities of timber. About 900,000 acres are non-productive forest land.
Excuse me, Mr. Epley. Senator Olson, do you have a...
Mr. Chairman, just a clarification. Now, you said 2.5 million acres were in the school trust fund, but it says there the university has 45% of that? So it's divided between the permanent school trust fund and the university?
Senator Sacksog, Senator Olson, that's correct.
Okay.
When I say school trust
fund. But, Mr. Epperly, the university trust fund in terms of its timber acres is not particularly large, is it?
Senator Sacksog, no, it is not. It's about 1% of the school trust acreage in total.
Okay. So it's not 45%. That's 45%
of part of the whole pie.
The whole circle, the pie.
Of the whole pie. Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman?
Yes. So hold on, Mr. Epperly. Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, do we have copies of this PowerPoint for the committee?
There should be a copy in your... You have one from Dave Shad or Dave Epperly?
We have Dave Shad's, not Dave Epperly's. This is just me.
No, I don't have it either.
That's what I was looking at.
What's that?
Hold on just a minute, Mr.
Look alike.
The same picture on the counter.
Been on the pro clubs over the summer?
No.
And all the work we did to get it.
For that extended bar.
Okay, well, what you have here is look-alikes. You have one that's got Dave Epperle on the front and Dave Shad on the front. Some of you may have two Dave Shads and some may have two Dave Epperles. So let's pull them out and see what we have here and get them spread around as quickly as we can.
Just have a Dave Shad. We don't have the Epperle one.
Yeah, I just have one also.
Just have one. And what does it say on the Senator Shad? What does yours say?
This is the Fish and Wildlife, but it's got some of the same.
The same one.
This is the same.
Is it in this folder?
Thing I have.
Okay. Got a copy of what I already.
But
we don't have.
Huh? Mr. Chairman, we got copies of what we already have.
We have
here.
Something with forests in here. There's forest stuff inside. Oh no, this is forest management.
That one is the right one.
Well, we don't have. Oh,
I think you're right. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
Mr. Chairman?
I like the one in color.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask a question?
Yeah, Senator Fredrickson.
Chairman, Mr. Epperle, I was looking at that pie chart, and I do not recall what the 1% Volstead acres are, 32,000. Could you tell us where they came from and why they're called Volstead?
Senator Soxhog, Senator Fredrickson, I need to get clarification on that myself.
Volstead Act was the Volstead the prohibition. What is the author of the Commerce
responsible for the prohibition?
Senator, this is Bob Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Bob Tomlinson, the Assistant Director of Forestry. My understanding is that is federal land. It's most of it's up in Lake of the Woods County. It was federal land granted to the state. I'm not sure when it was, way back when. But the origin was federal grants to the state.
Well, Mr. Chair, I could probably clarify that a little bit. Andrew Volstead was from Granite Falls, and he served as a member of Congress from 1902 to 1920. His opponent in 1920 was something of a scallywag, and he was thrown out, and Volstead was reappointed to his position for the rest of the term. So, but I think that's the origin of that particular piece of ground.
Okay. All right, well, what we're going to do here is that...
Volstead author of the prohibition?
Yes,
he was. But
what does this have to do with it?
He was also the author of the Capra-Volstead Act, which brought the rural cooperatives into existence. But he's a little better known for prohibition.
So what did he do with this? What's his name on this one for?
Well, he was the author of the legislation that brought it about as a public land.
Uh-huh. Okay. We're gonna do is everybody's gonna watch the PowerPoint. We're gonna make everybody a copy of the Epperle version. So thanks for bringing that to our attention, Senator Bach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Epperle, has the department taken a look at the 45% of state land that's school trust land, that 2.5 million acres? Has the department ever looked at some of that land that just has no potential to ever generate revenue, that maybe the permanent school fund would be best served if we actually sold the non-productive land, put the revenue in the trust, and then at least allowed it to raise revenue through investments if it has no opportunity to raise revenue as being non-productive for timber or for minerals? Has the department ever kind of done an assessment of those 2.5 million acres, do you know?
Senator Sacks, Senator Bach, the answer is yes. And the discussions that I'm involved in currently, those discussions are ongoing. But we have taken some action by removing some of these school trust lands out of parks, for example, and looking at how we might be able to consolidate trust lands and those kinds of things to help this idea of getting those lands into a long-term revenue-generating capacity.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I asked that question because I know we've got a number of acres, I think about 50,000 acres of school trust fund land sitting in SNA status, scientific and natural areas, and by law, we don't cut timber there, so there's just, and whether it's non-productive land, that's why we put it into SNAs or not, I'm not sure, but there are a number of classifications where the legislature and or the department has really taken away the revenue-reducing capacity on that land. Some of it's invested in old-growth forests. And I'm just kind of wondering if our charge isn't really, if our charge is to try and raise revenue for the trust, I'm not sure. I think a closer assessment of how actively some of it's being managed for revenue, I think, is probably something we should consider.
I think that's a point well made, Senator Bach.
Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Go ahead, Mr. Epley.
Senator Sacksock, thank you. And I was just getting to some of that point. Going right to the amount of acreage that is not productive for timber, those lands that are used for, you know, permanently covered in water or grasslands, peatlands, and the like are being reviewed. Interestingly enough, while today we sit, as Senator Bach just pointed out, those lands are being looked at how we could generate income from those kinds of lands. Timber harvesting's not the only way. Aside from the current economic situation we find ourselves in, there may be opportunities down the road for carbon markets or things like that, or increasing portfolios that require to have maybe an old growth stand within their portfolio. So those opportunities, while the opportunity hasn't played out, we're talking about those kinds of things. If we can't do that, then I think we're still going to work forward in moving school trust lands out of a non-revenue generating capacity by the various tools we have available. And Senator Bach was correct. School trust lands and SNAs, in terms of all of the school trust land and university land trust land that's available, represents about 3% of the land base. Less than 1% of it, or close to 1%, is in old growth status, which has values in it of itself, but not direct revenue generating benefits in the short run. So we're looking at those.
But and Mr. Epley, as you referred to just before you went into your latest point, with some of the legislation we passed last year, which allowed exchanges and even some outright purchases, it is possible to move productive and non-productive lands back and forth within the DNR or even within county lands, is it not?
Senator Sacksock, yes, that's true. One of the key points that I also wanted to make, and I apologize for the interruption with regard to the presentations. Oftentimes, I think there's too many Daves in the DNR, and we get confused ourselves. But, you know, the Minnesota statutes, Statute 127A.31, the goal of the permanent school fund land, reads this way: the legislature intends that it is the goal of the permanent school fund to secure the maximum long-term economic return from school trust lands consistent with the fiduciary responsibilities imposed by the trust relationship established in the Minnesota Constitution, with sound natural resource conservation and management principles, and with other specific policy provided in state law. That's 127A.31, paragraph C. And the reason why I have this slide on silviculture, and remember I earlier talked about this being a dynamic process. In order to generate revenue in terms of trees, we have to have a lot of investment in order to establish the stands, protect the stands, to grow them, to make high quality. And that's what silviculture is all about. Silviculture is the art and science of growing trees for a purpose. In this case, the purpose is economic long-term return from school trust lands with the associated values and making sure we do it in a sustainable way and conservation. It's very important, and this is where a lot of expenditures take place. The investments that we talk about, which do not have an immediate direct return, are in stand establishment, obviously. There's a cost there. The return is later. Site preparation, seeding, controlling competing vegetation all protects that stand to help it to get to a point where it generates revenue. Protecting seedlings from browsing and other damage associated with that is a cost. Creating room to grow via thinning. These are silvicultural objectives that are applied. By applying that kind of silviculture, we increase the growth, quality, and health of the trees and the associated values. Again, increasing growth and quality is very important to the sale of that and making sure that the products that we sell from the forest are of good quality. And we do this using a range of harvesting methods. And harvesting is where we get that return on the investments that we made. So it's very important, and I wanted to make that point of silviculture in this presentation. The kinds of tools that we need in sustainable forest management, and these are critical tools in order to provide some of the silvicultural things that we have, and that is forest and timber inventories, multidisciplinary planning, the employment and use of silviculture, forest product sales and contract management, wildfire protection, maintaining road access, and coordinating with neighbors and stakeholders. All of these tools are very, very important. And one of the things that from time to time we need to look at and review in order to make sure that we have the best tools available to us, particularly in forest and timber inventories and some of those kinds of things, is an important element. And one of the things that we've done just recently that I've looked at with all of the interest in increasing productivity, increased harvest levels, and increasing revenues on trees, I've looked at a couple. I have three advisory committees that were formed to advise me on economic analysis, for example, and making sure that the economic analysis that is being done is of high quality that we can use to make sure that our economic choices are in good shape and they provide value not only to us as land managers but to those that depend on the commodities. I have also formed a committee, an advisory group that looks at the sustainable harvest levels. And this group looks at all of the data that we have from various agencies and various sources that we provide consistent and reliable information because that is what people are making decisions on. So we're looking at our data sources and looking at modeling and looking at those kinds of things. It's an important advisory group to me. And the third advisory group, with the new customers coming online, and by new customers I mean those customers that aren't traditional forest product users, the power companies, those industries that are looking for biomass, things like that, there's a need to look at our business practices, and I have formed a timber business advisory group to look at everything from how we sell timber to ways that we can improve our methodology of making some of these things for sale. So these are very important tools, and those are some of the things that we're doing to try and keep up with these current times.
Question, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, coming from Michigan, you're probably well aware of the problem with the emerald ash borer. And, you know, we passed some legislation to try to slow down that spread. But if it gets into our northern forests, and you were just talking about biomass, for example, what can you do with that diseased wood? Is there anything you can do? If a whole forest had to be harvested because that disease broke out there, could you make any of it into regular timber? Would it have to be destroyed? What happens to it?
Senator Saxog, Senator, that's an excellent question, and hopefully emerald ash borer and the folks that the work that we're doing, people get the word on emerald ash borer. You're right, Minnesota is the third largest, has the third largest population of ash. I think I'll forget the states, but two of the eastern states, I think it's New York and Maine, have high population of ash trees. They're already being threatened. Michigan, of course, has gone through a tremendous amount of pain related to emerald ash borer. Those trees, we can utilize those trees with constraint. It is very, in order to control emerald ash borer, we need to go in and make, where we find an infestation, we need to, current guidelines are to harvest everything around it within a half mile radius. That wood can be utilized if it is in some way where it destroys the egg masses or the emerald ash borer first. It will be quarantined. It is a so you can't sell it nationally. It would be quarantined to where it probably local uses, and the likely use would be something like power generation or biomass generation or something of that nature. We're hoping it doesn't get here. It's not here yet. But it's the kinds of things that we're prepared and are preparing in dealing with, and that includes looking for different methods of disposal and use that would help mitigate the problems associated with an insect like that.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. the ways we... how we fund trust fund forest management... I think I skipped a slide. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's not there.
There it is.
Okay. Let me just. Okay. I have another slide available. We'll see where it comes in. I was just looking at that. It shows a trend. I don't know why it's not in there. Trust fund land contributes value to the state's. Excuse me. How we fund trust fund, fund forest management investment costs and costs associated with harvest on trust funds are in this manner. The general fund and the forest management investment account together fund these forest management activities on trust fund lands, many of which are investments that ensure the future revenues. Those are the kinds of things that I pointed out in the silvicultural slide. The investments are site preparation, those types of things that allow for us to have future revenues. Revenues from timber sales and other activities from the trust fund lands are then deposited in the forest suspense account. The forest suspense account reimburses the general fund for administration and protection costs and the FMIA account for management, improvement, and forest road costs. The remainder of the forest suspense account is then deposited in the corpus of the trust. And I apologize, I don't seem to see the slide, and you don't have my handout currently? Is that?
We do, and I
do have
the
handout. Okay. In your handout, hopefully, is a slide that has a graph that says revenue to the trust from fund management. It's a blue graph that looks like this.
Forest management.
Forest management, yes.
This one?
That's the one. And I want you to focus in on the trend line because the average amount of revenue that is returned to the corpus of the trust. From 2002 to 2007, that was an average of $4.2 million per year. Much of the variation over time that is due to market fluctuations, like things like stumpage price increase or decreases, industry demand, and weather is a huge factor in some of these costs. And those costs associated with dealing with those variables in any given fiscal year. So those are the kinds of things that why you see an up and down pattern in that graph from year to year. Fire, for example, from 1997, 2002, and 2007 were peak fire years that had a high amount of cost. Those were years where our costs associated with that went up. It was those kinds of variation. But the trend line, if you take each of the five-year running averages, the trend line is an upward climb of revenues going into the corpus of the trust. So that's an important slide.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Senator Ann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Epperle, if maybe I'm incorrect in this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if we look at the revenue going to the trust from the management of the land as a say the private model could be viewed as profit, the profits from the activity, and you're saying they generated an average of $4.2 million over a course of the last several years, and your chart shows fluctuation, which is reasonable. What is the asset base that these returns are being generated on? What that $4.2 million is on what dollar value at base? And I assume that is going to fluctuate somewhat, too, although if the land is a constant quantity, I guess it's going to fluctuate just with, some kind of evaluation of the land itself. But can you comment on what that rate of return is on the investment?
Well, yeah, you know, before you answer, Mr. Epperle, Senator Hand, I think that as Mr. Epperle said at the beginning, there's investment, there's long-term investment that's constantly going into this, and he's
Chairman,
got, and he's going to have the answer.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I agree with that, and yeah. what I guess I'm getting at is the kind of activity that we're seeing done here on behalf of the state and on behalf of the school trust fund is not unusual activity. There are a lot of private businesses that operate for us,
yep.
And they do it for profit, and they do it for probably identical reasons as we see spelled out in statute, but they do it for their shareholders. And so part of, I think, when we're looking as a committee of what is our evaluation of this, I think we ought to look at what other people do. And that's kind of what I'm getting at, is how do we do this compared to how it's done other places? And so one of the questions is this amount of return or excess that's going to fund the trust, is that reasonable or not compared to what? And that's the question.
Well,
I'm
Mr.
getting.
Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator Bob.
Mr. Chairman, I think one of the problems, Senator Hahn, is, I mean, there's a lot of fire suppression costs, for example, that are charged against the permanent school fund. Now, is it really a fair, I mean, we're going to do fire suppression, whether it's permanent school fund land or not. Now, we assess a lot of those costs against the permanent school fund, but the truth is, we have to do fire suppression work, whether it's acquired land or school trust fund land. I mean, we don't expect forest fires to run rampant in the forest. So I think it's a little hard to measure. There's some public safety issues, I think, that we charge against the trust that we would have to do, you know, whether it was trust fund land or not. So I think sometimes it's a little hard to measure. Some of the trust fund land generates a lot of revenue. I mean, the trust fund land that has minerals on it, most of the principal of that trust is from minerals. It's not from timber. It's not from sales. It's from mining activity. So I think on the timber side, the rate of return as a percentage of the value of the asset is probably low, but I think it's low for a whole bunch of reasons, and fire suppression would be one of them.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Bakken, I agree. The point I'm trying to make is that whatever we have to do to manage this forest for the behalf of the state, I would think are identical to the kinds of things that would have to be done if it was a private forest being managed for the benefit of shareholders. They would also have to be concerned about fires and the loss of the asset and the continuation of its growing as a revenue stream and all the things that we're talking about here. All I'm trying to get at, and maybe what you're talking about, maybe what we are doing in terms of fire suppression is excessive compared to what the benefit is. I don't know. But I think the problem that we're wrestling with here is how do we evaluate this and how do we say this is good, this is bad, how do we do it differently if we can't come to that? And I'm just trying to get, are there things that we can compare to? And since this is activity that is done other places, it would seem to me that it would be reasonable to look at that and then ask the same kind of questions and recognize, I think you're right, there are costs to managing forests that are unique to forest management. But they would be there regardless of whether it was a state forest or a private forest. And I'm just not clear yet, and I don't think any of us are, on what these costs are in terms of reasonability compared to some standard. And I don't know what that standard is, and that's part of what I'm trying to get at. And maybe
so Mr. Eppley and answering Senator Hans, is there any, and maybe see if I'm phrasing this right, is there any other either states or government subdivisions, is there anything we can compare with it to see if we think we're doing an efficient job?
Senator Soxhawk, Senator Hand, yes, there is. There are other trust funds in Minnesota. There are other trust lands in other states. Having been in three states and the Great Lakes states, these school trust fund lands, and I think I bring a unique perspective, are managed quite well. The difference is that you will likely find, and we certainly can study them, and I'm not trying to defend, but the differences are largely related to minerals. Some states have huge gas and oil. Other states have become more urbanized. The more eastern states have become more urbanized. And so, rightly or wrongly, they sold off a lot of their trust lands. Here in the Midwest, we have these lands provide values well beyond, sometimes intangible values, but well beyond what we generate in terms of dollars. But, Senator Hahn, you hit something that I'm very passionate about. How can we get the most out of the work that we do, realizing that the dollars that we receive today are returns from investments made in the past, and the investments that we're making today ensure returns in the future. Those costs obviously fluctuate. Interestingly enough, and I think I can answer this, I know Dr. Kilgore is in the room and he probably could tell you better, but long-term forest management at best may return somewhere around an annual rate of return of 8%. That's pretty good if you think about what you have in terms of quality, what you in markets and stability and all of those kinds of things. And so you try to keep that in mind as you manage it. And in the Division of Forestry in particular, we're looking at these things where we try to optimize those business practices to get the maximum rate of return using the with the constraints that we have or within the arena that we find ourselves. And that includes everything from weather to fluctuating markets and the desire to maintain these other values.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ann.
Thank you. And Mr. Eppley, I appreciate that. And I'm not trying to, just knowing I don't know a lot about your background. You gave us a great introduction, and I think you have a great background for this. And I don't doubt for a second your passion to do this, and I think it's well placed. I'm just trying to take the perspective if we are the owners, the shareholders of a business, which kind of we are, that is being run to operate it for the purpose of funding a particular thing that we're interested in, schools in this case, how do we evaluate the performance of that business? If we don't have any kind of benchmark or any kind of comparative thing to measure against. And so that's really the heart of my question. And I think it would be good for us as a committee to have, if there are other states, for example, that have forest lands and that are doing similar things, that we should look at how do those states do, how does Minnesota do with the management of its forest lands, recognizing there will be differences, or if there are private forests that are being managed, so that we as shareholders or owners or board of directors, whatever the role, whatever the comparable analogy might be, that we can say we with some level of confidence believe this is good, or if it isn't, then it would prompt us maybe to say, well, what can we do differently to improve this? It's very difficult, at least for me, to right now make a decision whether we have to do anything differently than we do today, because I don't know if $4.2 million is reasonable, high, low, good, bad. I have nothing to compare it to. And that's really the heart of my question.
Senator Saxog, Senator Hahn, I think part of the challenge for the department is a lot of these revenues are market-driven. I mean, for instance, today the demand for wood products is down significantly because of the national housing situation. So consequently, their wood on the stump that we're growing on school trust land that was selling 2 years ago for $100 a cord now is selling for $25. So the revenue they're going to take in is significantly reduced, out of their control. No matter what they do to manage it, it's market-driven. And which brings me to my question, Mr. Epperly, what is the status of the forest management investment account, knowing that stumpage prices are down significantly from when that fund was set up? And is there going to be adequate money in that account going into the next biennium to fund the activities of the department, or are we going to have to find a way to supplement the money that's going into the forest management investment account? Do we know that yet?
Senator Saxog, Senator Bach, that's an excellent question. The forest management investment account is in trouble. We are not allowed to run that account into the red, and so we have to make choices to make sure that we don't. But the direct effect of the market downturns and those kinds of things had a significant impact on the revenue generating capability on the kinds of things that go into that fund. And so while the I's haven't been dotted and the T's are crossed of where we're at today, I can tell you that we have taken steps to manage that fund so that it doesn't go into the red. But we couldn't have continued along by means of the way we were going and if we hadn't taken these cost-saving steps. And that's where this flexibility is important in forest management. We could be challenged by weather. We could be challenged by fluctuating market things. All of those kinds of things, it requires us to have flexible management tools to be able to mitigate that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, are there privately owned forest lands that are diverse in their product? Because as Senator Bach raised, some of this goes into the housing market. I know that some of the paper mills do own land, and I presume they're looking for the popple or the kinds of woods that they can use in the paper-making process, and not necessarily the diversity that we might have and be using to generate revenue here. But haven't some of those companies even decided not to do that anymore and sell them off, that they're better off if they sell them and these lands get developed, which has caused us a little bit of consternation, too, of breaking up some of those lands? I've been trying to track with Senator Hahn's concern. Do we have any, and so I guess I boil it down, do we have any comparable private sector operations that would match the nature of the management of forests that we do in the public sector?
Senator Saxog, Senator Olson, there are other forests out there that we can compare to, and that there are companies that are divesting of their forest lands, decoupling their forest lands. They're being picked up by timber investment management organization, real estate investment trusts, and private landowners. Some of those decisions are being made on that where they divest of their lands, or where the TIMOs or the REITs divest of their lands are based on the high value of the land. Land recently was at a premium. With the new economic era that we're in now, land values are dropping. That's going to change that dynamic. They do industry that depends on land as a real estate investment trust buys and sells based on what they're trying to manage, whether it be timber or land itself. And they may not they might not stay permanently. So those are issues. Can we compare to other forests? Yes, but in order to compare to other forests, we have to make sure we compare apples to apples in terms of timber productivity, quality, location, everything from access to all those kinds of things. So it's very important.
Is there such a thing? Is there a comparable out there, which is what he's been asking for the last half hour?
Yes. Here.
Is there a comparable out there that we could, that you could in fact measure that it's public enough information to know what kind of a return they get on it in comparison with what our state operations are doing?
And the answer is yes, there is a comparable. We can, there are other trusts right in Minnesota that we can look at.
Have you done that? Did you have an answer to that?
I don't have an answer that I can give you today, and I don't know how much of it has been studied. I know Dr. Kilgore is here. He has done some work on tax-forfeited lands, for example. And so those kinds of things we can bring forward.
Mr. Chairman?
Excuse me just a minute, Senator Frederickson. But as we move along here, I think what the DNR and eventually Dr. Zemeta of the Minnesota Forest Resource Council is going to do is to give us ideas of potential changes to improve the management of these forests. And I want to make sure we get through that without talking too much. Though these points are well taken, and we need to find out this information. Senator Hand, did you have another?
Well, I just wanted to return to the original question that I asked, which was, what is the value of the land that's generating the $4.2 million? In other words, what is the asset base that we're getting the $4.2 million revenue off of, and just as we could, so then we could do a simple calculation, it's generating X off of this. And do you have that number? And I guess secondly, to kind of keying off of Senator Olson's comment, if there are these comparable things, we should take a look at those and add that to the information of this committee to say, all right, here are the 4, 5, 6 different comparable things, and we can compare what they're doing versus what we're doing, which may give us some clues as to the kinds of changes that we maybe ought to make going forward, if any. But
Mr. Chairman,
if you can answer that question of what the asset value is that the $4.2 million is coming
from.
Yeah, I'm sure.
That's up and down.
Well, can you answer that, Mr. Eberle, before we talk to Senator Frederickson here?
Senator Sacksock, Senator Hand, yes, I can. The bulk of the revenue comes from the 18,000 acres of land that are harvested annually. There is the additional revenue comes from 15% of the timber sales that are sold. That's the bulk of the revenue that comes in any given fiscal year. There are other things that add to that amount, but that's the lion's share of the revenues that are generated in any given year.
But Mr. Chairman,
it's the value of the land he's asking for.
I'm trying to get at, if I have $100 and I invest it and I get a 2% return, that's maybe good. But if I have $100 and I get 4% return, that's twice as good.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, what is the return that we're getting that this $4.2 million represents?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Eberle, can you do that? I mean, if you can't do that right now, let's just get that answer when
yes,
we can.
I think we can get that answer to you. I can't do that right
all
now.
All right.
Mr. Chairman?
Good. Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, it's an interesting question, but to value property, it needs to be on the market or be available in the market, and this land will never be on the market. So there's not any of this land being sold. There might be comparable land being sold, so you might come at some value, but it's never going to be on the market. We might swap some land, but it won't be for sale. The other element I think has been missing in this discussion is, in comparing private and public lands, is this public land is a multiple-use land. Private land might be just for growing timber and not be open to any other use. Our public forest lands are open to multiple use besides. And there's value to the forest besides just what gets cut and processed and used and sold. Hunting, fishing, snowmobiling, all the other camping, cross-country skiing, all those things occur in the forest, and they all have a value too. I just happened to look at the page in the handoff from David Shad, and it says, hunting, fishing, and watching wildlife accounts for $3.6 million of activity in Minnesota. Part of that activity occurs on this forest trust land, and that is of value to us, too. Now,
maybe we should be somehow or other tapping part of that $3.6 billion and putting it in the trust fund. I don't know, but I think that's one major difference between private and public.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Ferguson, I agree. But if I go back and look at the slide that talks about the goal of permanent school trust fund, as good as those other goals are, I would say that there's nothing in this mandate that would fit. In other words, this says managing the property to secure the maximum long-term economic return. That's what the lands are for. And it might be good that they're used for hunting and fishing and other things, but those activities do not go to the goal of securing the maximum long-term economic return from the use of those lands. That's my point, is that I agree with you that public lands have other purposes, but if the goal of this land is for this purpose, then we ought to try to make sure it gets done.
And Senator Hand, back to my original point, we kind of got to get through this testimony today because there are some new ideas here. And, in fact, it may increase the value and the income on the lands we're talking about. Senator Tom Soni.
I'll pass, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. All right. Continue, Mr. Airplane.
There it is. Well, Mr. Chair, it just so happens that I am at the end of the slides. I just wanted to make the point that less than 2% of the acreage of the trust fund forests are harvested in any given year. The long-term investments in forest management and trust lands provide substantial and sustainable returns. Trust fund lands contribute significantly to the state's ecological health, forest-based economy, and quality of life, and Minnesota's native forests are diverse and serve many purposes. So with that, I'll wrap up.
Good. And any other questions? Go ahead, Senator Thomson.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I think you have a slide here where half of the 900,000 cords of wood purchased annually by the forest products industry from the DNR come from the trust fund forests.
Senator Sacksock, Senator Tomasoni, yes, that's correct.
Then how much of the DNR's budget for managing forests actually come out of the trust fund from the suspense account? In other words, how much are all your revenues for managing forests out of the trust fund, or where do you get all your revenues from for managing forests?
Senator Sacksock, if I may, I'll call Bob Tomlinson up. I think sure. He can provide a very direct answer.
Mr. Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, our general operating budget is right around $30 million a year. About 56% of that, I believe, is forest management investment account funding, and the balance is general fund, 44%.
For managing forests,
the general operating budget we call.
Okay, and how much of it comes from the trust fund lands?
Of the forest management, in the forest management investment account, I believe the appropriation in 08 is about $14 million. About 60% of that is derived as costs that come back out of the corp from the trust fund lands.
And, Mr. Chairman, just out of curiosity, what if all the money from the trust fund lands went where it's supposed to go, and as the Constitution says, to school aids, what would be the effect on the management of the forest management account, besides the fact that they wouldn't have the $14 million? Would you still be able to manage the lands?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, I think we'd find it difficult to fund the general operations of the Division of Forestry in order to put up future timber sales and do the other investments that we think are necessary on the school trust fund lands. And
Senator Thomas, sorry, we could get the $14 million from the general fund.
We could,
and then we could take that $14 million and put it right in the school.
Well, I would be willing to bet there's hundreds of millions of dollars that have come out of the trust fund lands from forestry that could be in school trust fund right now that aren't in there because of the management fees that have been charged. So I don't know what the number is, but I know it's been going on for about 30 or 40 years. So,
but we understand with legislation and all, I mean, it is a robbing Peter to pay Paul situation.
It is now.
Yeah. Well, that's what we're working on right now.
Let me ask this question then. Is it, do we pay exactly the same amount to manage trust fund lands as we do manage other forest lands?
Mr. Chair, members, yes. We basically manage three types of lands, as I testified before this committee a month or so ago. You know, we've got CONCON lands, acquired lands, and the school trust fund lands. All of the way we get revenues coming into the forest management investment account, it's the amount of money, the cost that we incur that we certify against the school suspense account, all of that then comes back into the forest management investment account, which basically it helps then you reappropriate back to us and it helps us operate. 100% of the revenues off of acquired lands comes back to the forest management investment account, and 50% roughly of the revenues off of CONCON lands, because the other 50% goes to the counties. That's the way it works. The costs are the same. You know, it costs us the same amount of money to put up a timber sale and administer it on acquired lands as it does on CONCON lands or trust fund lands. It costs us a similar amount of money to fight fires on CONCON lands and trust fund lands and acquired lands. The costs basically don't vary all that much. It's the proportion that you folks agreed to. When we, by the way, took a general fund reduction when we set up those forest management investment accounts, remember, it wasn't a windfall for the Department of Natural Resources to have that FMI account established. We took a corresponding decrease in the amount of general fund. But it's just a dedicated account based on timber revenues that are coming in off of these trust fund, CONCON, and acquired lands.
Answer your question, Senator Thompson?
Maybe.
Okay. Senator Bott.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Epperly, or Mr. Tomlinson, has the federal government reimbursed us for the state costs relative to the Ham Lake fire or the Cavity Lake fire? We got forest fires that started on federal land in the federal wilderness and grew out of there. The state incurred some significant costs. I'm just wondering if we've been reimbursed adequately by the federal government for our costs relative to their fire.
Senator Saxhog, Senator Bach, yes, we have been reimbursed for those costs.
And then, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Epperly, is the permanent school fund then reimbursed for their share, or where does that federal reimbursement money go?
Senator Saxhog, Senator Bach, the answer is no. But the
I don't think any of those lands were on school trust lands.
No, but I think Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, I think where you're coming from with this question is because of the fact that the permanent school fund, part of the cost associated with managing school fund, trust fund lands is associated with firefighting. And we had a big outlay of expenses, which we certified costs again. Then the question is, when we're getting back the federal dollars, are we thus paying back the corpus of the trust relative to that? And I think the answer is no to that. I think that's one of those ones that we have to go back and kind of do a little analysis. And probably the reason is because that those reimbursements from the feds don't come back in, of course, in year 07, which is when those fires occurred and things. But that's one we'd have to do a little research on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bach. Okay, any other questions for the gentleman? Thank you very much.
Yeah, as long as
it is helpful. We've got other questions that we've developed here, and we'll hopefully get those answers, and we'll be talking.
Senator, thank you.
The next gentleman we have is Dave Shad. He's the Department of Natural Resources Director of Fish and Wildlife. And does everybody have the?
Yes.
I raised it all privately, I guess.
That's you don't. Okay, we're going to get look at that for a while, and we'll get you. Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair, just in summary, yes. I would just like to go back to what Senator Bach raised as a question, and I want to make sure that Mr. Epperling and that you understand that that is the intent of this committee, that we believe those funds ought to be reimbursed because of that's just what's right. So I'd like to know the answer, but I want to make certain that it's also clear that we believe it ought to be reimbursed.
Right, Senator, I agree, and we're kind of going along here with what the goal of the Permanent School Trust Fund is, and
at the risk of getting further into the weeds to Senator Bonnef's question, you know, the state owns some firefighting aircraft, okay? Now, the Permanent School Fund pays part of the ongoing costs of that through the fire suppression that's charged to the Permanent School Fund. Those aircraft are deployed all over the United States to fight fires. So if you really want to get in the weeds, when we charge Idaho and Montana and Colorado and California for firefighting with aircraft that is to some extent paid for by the Permanent School Fund or the ongoing maintenance and costs of maintaining it, when we receive money from California or Idaho or Colorado, does any of that money flow into the Permanent School Fund? And I didn't mean probably to not take the committee that far in the weeds, but this is very complicated. And that was my reason for wanting to raise it.
Or do our costs to those states encompass part of the maintenance and that part of it that is being covered by somebody else?
I'm not looking for an answer today, but it's complicated. It's very complicated stuff. And fire suppression is a public.
There's no question. I mean, I don't. So if Bland and Papers lands caught on fire and there's a forest fire there, who pays ultimately for that? I don't know. Is that part of their tax dollars at work? But again, it's because of Senator Lynch's legislation here that it is going to make a difference. And so that's what we're talking about. Mr. Shad, it's good to see you again.
Senator, thank you. For the record, my name is Dave Shad. I'm the Fish and Wildlife Director for Department of Natural Resources, and welcome to the Dave show.
That's right.
I understand why this has gotten kind of confusing. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the non-timber values associated with trust fund lands and how we manage these lands to comply with our constitutional responsibility, our fiduciary responsibility to look after the trust, but also provide for other benefits to the citizens of the state. And I'll primarily focus on wildlife benefits and some of the recreational opportunities that come with those benefits. And before I start, maybe just a comment here. Senator Saxog and myself and a few others in the room here were fortunate enough to travel together to Finland earlier this year on a trip sponsored by the Blandin Foundation to look at how they manage their forests. We also took a trip up to Ontario to look at Canadian approaches to forest management. And the goal of this was to look at ways that we can increase the productivity of our forests. And some of the things that we observed in Finland I think are going to be really useful to bring back here to Minnesota and see if we can apply here. And I think Dave Zometa is going to touch on some of those things. But what we also observed in Finland were forests that had as their primary focus of management one of economic return and very little attention paid to some of these other values, especially wildlife values. And the lack of diversity within those forests, the lack of kind of living creatures in those forests, I think was really striking to all of us. And so I think we learned some very helpful things there, but we also, I think saw some things that we need to be cautious about as we work to increase productivity of our forests here in Minnesota. First, just a little bit of background on wildlife resources in Minnesota forests. We're blessed with very diverse forests here in Minnesota, and that's reflected in diversity of wildlife. We have approximately 300 species of wildlife that are dependent on forest habitats for some part of their life cycle. About 10% of those species are either endangered, threatened, or special concern species. And obviously, the decisions we make related to management of these forests site by site are going to create winners and losers. Every one of these species has a little different habitat need, And those needs change throughout the season and throughout those animals' life cycles. And so this is very complex. And I think what's important is that across all the lands, all the forested lands, and over time, that we not put this tremendous diversity at risk. Senator Frederickson referenced this slide, and I do need to correct him. There was an error on the hard copy that he had. The expenditures related to fishing, hunting, and watching wildlife in Minnesota are $3.6 billion, not million dollars annually. You can see that these are average expenditures per participant for angling, hunting, and wildlife viewing. But this is a huge economic driver for the state. Large sectors of our retail, our resort and travel industries are very, very dependent on having healthy fish and wildlife populations and the recreational opportunities that come with those. And obviously, the 2.5 million acres of trust fund lands are critical in supporting this economic activity.
Senator Anderson has a.
Oh, question. I just wanted to know if you can translate those numbers into tax revenues. Has that study been done to show how much tax revenue comes in from those uses of those public lands?
That, Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, that is available, and I can provide that to you.
I think it would be useful to have that as we look side by side with what our expenditures are for those from the public.
Senator Bach?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Shad, the angling number looked really big. Does that include boats? We just assume that somebody buys a boat to go fishing with it, or I mean, I'm just wondering if the category shouldn't be broader than hunting, fishing, if it shouldn't actually say boating on there. I mean, boat sales are a big deal, and we make a lot of boats in Minnesota, but I mean, I know people that bought boats and don't fish out of them. So should the category be a little bit bigger than maybe include boating or something on it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, actually these numbers come from federal surveys, and they have actually looked at that. They've looked at the proportion of boating use that's for fishing versus other purposes. They've had to do that as they split up federal gas tax proceeds or revenues, and so this is the proportion of boat purchasing that can be attributed to fishing activity. Wanted to just point out a couple of statutes that drive forest management and provide direction to us as we manage forests in the state. The first is MS-89A.02, and I didn't print the whole thing out here. It's pretty lengthy, but just wanted to point out a couple of key aspects of this. First of all, this statute directs that forest management in the state be sustainable, and there's actually a definition in the statute for sustainable management. It's subdivision 13, and it reads very simply that sustainable means meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And I think we can all agree, whether it's trust fund or any other lands, that concept of sustainability is pretty important. Subdivision 8 also defines what we mean by forest resources, and it defines it very broadly as not just timber, but, and I'll just read the list here, biological diversity, recreation, fish and wildlife habitat, wilderness, rare and distinctive flora and fauna, air, water, soil, climate, and educational, aesthetic, and historic values. So it's very, very broad. And then just a final point on this side, you'll note that the Act directs that we look at both site and landscape levels as we manage our forests. And I think this is important. I'll come back to that a little bit later here in my presentation. As far as school trust lands, we've got some further direction from the legislature. This is in 127A.31, and I've highlighted in blue a couple of key terms here that I want to bring your attention to. The first is that reference to long-term economic return from school trust lands. This is a recognition that we not sacrifice future return from these lands for short-term economic gain, and I think this is consistent with that first statute related to sustainability. The second highlighted area here is direction that we manage these lands consistent with sound natural resource conservation and management principles. And for the remainder of my time, I'd like to just discuss how we approach the second responsibility, and again, how we manage both and plan and manage these lands at both landscape and site levels to kind of carry out these dual responsibilities, one, to provide revenue for the trust, long-term economic revenue for the trust, and balancing that out with this sound natural resource conservation and management directive. This map shows the distribution of DNR-administered lands. In red, we've got trust fund lands. Green are our non-trust lands. And within those green lands, there's a variety of types of land. There's acquired forestry lands. That's the bulk of those lands, especially in the forested part of the state. But also included here would be wildlife management areas, state parks and scientific and natural areas, aquatic management areas that kind of have a riparian focus to them. And then not shown here would be county-administered lands, federal forest lands, and that sort of thing. An important point here, though, is that each category of land brings with it a different mandate and a different emphasis. For example, trust fund lands have this economic, long-term economic return direction associated with them. Wildlife management areas have as their primary focus wildlife production and associated recreation. And so as we look across the landscape, we need to consider these different mandates for these lands and ensure that as we manage for these specific values based on this direction that we've got for each of these land types, that across all these lands, all the values, all the uses kind of collectively are provided for. And for that reason, we put a premium and we spend quite a bit of time on landscape-based planning. It's a very, very important tool for us to kind of step back and make sure that across large areas of the state, we're making sure that that diversity of wildlife that I mentioned earlier and those many uses associated with our forests are provided for. We do this landscape-level planning in several ways. The Minnesota Forest Resources Council has initiated landscape level planning efforts in various parts of the state where they've brought various folks together. It's representatives from the forest products industry, citizens, hunters, local communities to develop a vision for what we want these future forests to look like and what kind of products we want from our forests. Within the Department of Natural Resources, we do what are called subsection forest resource management plans. And on the map shown here on the screen, each one of these colored areas is what we call a subsection within our ecological classification system. And that's the basis for our landscape-level plans. We consider the direction provided by the Forest Resource Council landscape plans, but also look at specific mandates that we've got for lands that we administer, and certainly the trust fund mandates that we have as we develop our vision for what state lands within that landscape, what we want those to look like in 50 years. In both cases, we engage the public, whether it's landowners or the industry or local residents, to help us define that future direction. And the really important piece of this landscape planning is that we can't manage for every value, we can't manage for every wildlife species at every site or on every piece of land. And kind of the art and science of forest management is making sure that as we manage site by site across the landscape, that collectively we're making sure that nothing falls through the cracks and that society, whether it's the forest products industry, whether it's hunters, whether it's wildlife viewers or berry pickers or any other folks, are getting the benefits that they desire from those forest lands. Moving down from the landscape level to the site level, there are some things we can do to provide wildlife benefits, and we've got wildlife managers spread across the forested part of the state that work very closely with foresters to develop timber harvest plans, regeneration plans, in a way that, that features such as those shown here on this slide can be maintained or created while still achieving the primary objectives of management. And, of course, those are going to vary from site to site. We also use site-level management guidelines that have been developed by the Forest Resource Council to ensure that forest management at the site level is done in a way that's sustainable and that considers some of these other values, these other uses of lands, and especially wildlife. And these are a few elements of those guidelines that have real direct applicability to wildlife. But these guidelines, I think, are a very, very important element in ensuring that our management of these trust lands is consistent with sound natural resource conservation and management principles, that direction that the legislature has provided us as far as how we manage those trust fund lands. This points out, I think, that these natural resource these natural resources and their uses are really interconnected, and that we can't manage them in isolation. And so, again, by using both landscape and site level approaches, we ensure that our forest management program provides not only economic benefits but also these environmental and recreational benefits. And what I'd like to do with the remaining time I've got here is just quickly go through an example of how we might apply this landscape and site level planning and management to a stand. And what I'd like to do is just take an aspen stand that might be 40, 50, 60 years old, very typical kind of forest stand that we might see in northern Minnesota. It's a stand that's ready for harvest. There's certainly a market out there for that, so we need to decide as we make decisions about how we're going to harvest and regenerate that stand, what we want it to look like in the future. And so first of all, we take a look at our landscape plan. We look at the location of that stand on the landscape. We take a look at soils, things like access, certainly the type of land. If it's trust land versus wildlife land, would have a direct bearing on the direction we want to take that stand into the future. And then we'd look at any unique attributes. If there was a rare species or a rare plant community on that stand, that would influence our approach to management, certainly. There might be a deer wintering area or some other wildlife feature that we want to emphasize. And so based on all of this, we make a decision on kind of the objective for our management of that stand, and then develop a silvicultural approach to get us there. One option might be to actually convert the stand from an aspen stand to a multiple-age mixed conifer and hardwood stand. And you can see an example of how we might proceed with management there, where we, over the course of 70 years, we might enter that stand three or four times to either pull some product out of there or replant underneath that stand. And based on this kind of management, the value of that product is going to be very different at different stages of this stand. The value to wildlife and the recreation that we're providing is going to be very different as that stand matures and as we apply management. And this would be a very sustainable approach, one that would certainly provide economic benefit or revenue to the state, either to the trust or to the general fund, and also provide for these other values. A second option for that stand would be to, rather than to convert it to a mixed stand, would be to continue to manage it as an aspen stand. And in that case, we would clear cut it and allow the stand to naturally regenerate to aspen and return again in 30 or 40 or 50 years and clear cut it again. And in that case, we'd be serving a very different segment of the industry as far as the product we're providing there. We'd also be providing a very different wildlife value, a very different recreational experience. But this approach would be no less sustainable. And the key here is to apply these different options across the landscape in the right places, in the right amounts, and to design the harvest and design the regeneration plans with these voluntary guidelines in mind so that it is sustainable. Just a few slides to close here, and I just want to reemphasize the point that we can carry out this primary responsibility on trust lands, this fiduciary responsibility, while also providing for some of these other amenities or other values, whether it's wildlife or recreation, might be water quality or whatever. But our citizens value these lands for many reasons, and including some of these other values. And I think in this case, we can have our cake and eat it too. And I think we've got good processes in place to ensure that we do that. Those processes, again, are these landscape level and site level approaches that we use to ensure that this management is sustainable. And this idea of sustainable management is important not only for these other values that these trust lands are provided, but also if you just look from the trust standpoint and future and long-term economic returns to the trust, this idea of sustainability is very important. And then I want to close with just a thought, and it relates to Senator Bach's earlier comment about lands that aren't producing revenue. And I think one of the challenges we've got here is that forestry, by its nature, is a pretty long-term endeavor. When we're planting a tree now, that tree probably won't be harvested for 40, 50, maybe 100 years. And I don't think anybody can predict what kind of uses, what kind of values, what kind of needs society will demand from our forests even 10 years from now, much less 40 or 100 years from now. You know, it might be pulp, it might be boards, it might be biomass, it might be carbon storage, it might be biochemicals, it might be some product that we're not even envisioning now. And I think when you're looking not only kind of long-term from a sustainability standpoint, but also long-term from a revenue standpoint related to the trust, I think having a diverse forest and a healthy forest kind of first and foremost will provide for that flexibility, provide options for future forest managers and future legislatures to respond to those future markets and make sure that trust is the needs of that trust are being developed, but also the needs of citizens are being developed.
Mr. Thank you, David. Question, Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Shad, this last session, the legislature made some changes to the Agricultural Green Acres program. Turns out there was a lot of farmland that was enrolled in Green Acres that wasn't being used for agriculture. And I've started to hear from some of them, and what I've heard several times is, well, yeah, the stuff I have enrolled isn't, I'm not tilling it, but I've worked with the DNR wildlife people, and they've told me that they'd like to have it in natural native grasses. So we have all kinds of land enrolled in Green Acres. It's not being tilled, but somebody has worked with the landowner to put it in native grasses or in wildlife, and those are all good things, but they're not agriculture things. So I'm wondering, so I don't think they fit the Green Acres program very well. I'm wondering if the department has ever considered some kind of a program where a landowner, private landowner, could enroll their land maybe in some kind of a native grasses program or in a wildlife program, much like we have in forestry with the Sustainable Forest Initiative. Very, very good program that's trying to preserve forests. Maybe we should consider some kind of an enrollment program for people that are willing to enroll their land for some conservation purpose. Maybe it's something we should consider, because I do believe we'd get better landscape planning, and we probably could do it cheaper, Senator Han, if private landowners were willing to do more active management of private land. And with the SFIA, it seems to be working pretty well with forestry. And, you know, we always hear around here there's a lot of interest in the state acquiring more land for wildlife management areas or whatever. And I wonder if maybe the better approach might be for us as it relates to wildlife and conservation to work with private landowners, create some kind of an incentive for them like we have for forestry, and maybe that would be a very good use of, frankly, there's money for that. I mean, we sell hunting and fishing licenses every year. We could easily, that seems to me would be a reasonable use of some game and fish fund money to help private landowners manage for wildlife or native grasses if they wanted to. Is it anything the department's ever considered, kind of based on the model that forestry is doing with the SFIA program?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, I couldn't agree with you more, and I think in agricultural portions of the state where 90 or 95% of the land is privately owned, figuring out how to motivate landowners to do conservation on their lands is really going to be key if we're going to support healthy fish and wildlife populations in that landscape. We have developed approaches. The Rim Reserve Program is one where we, it's voluntary, and landowners enroll their program. They get a payment to set aside those lands and create habitat. The Federal Farm Bill has other programs that kind of speak to those kinds of needs and those kinds of interests. And we're experimenting out there, looking at different ways to motivate landowners to do things on their lands. Many of these landowners are running a business. We need to figure out a way to make it worth their while financially. A lot of them are very conservation-minded. They're willing to do it, but it needs to make sense, and you know, for their pocketbook and for their families. And we've got some programs. Our Working Lands Initiative is one example of that, where we're trying to figure out new and different and better ways to try to get conservation on the ground on private lands and agricultural areas of the state.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Shad, I appreciate that. And I'd be interested in knowing maybe what some other states are doing. But I know as it relates to forestry, that program works really, really well. And, you know, wildlife habitat doesn't require the big, vast acreages that forestry does. I mean, you know, 20 acres here and there can make a big difference for managing wildlife, and it seems like we should be able to put some kind of a program together to encourage private landowners to help us with this landscape planning. So I look forward to working with the department on something in that area, I think.
Good. Senator Bach.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, I appreciate that suggestion, and there's quite a bit of work being done on that in the city that I represent, Minnetonka. I was a planning commissioner, and whenever a developer would come before us with and wanting to develop certain areas that previously had been undeveloped, we negotiate them putting part of the land in conservation easements. And anytime a homeowner wants a variance, we look at it from the perspective of, can we get some more land in conservation easements in order to give this? And we use it as a bartering tool. But I can see how we've actually done quite a bit in the city of Minnetonka to preserve land and to turn land that wasn't good into land that is really contributing to the community with that practice. And I can see how that could be used on a broader basis.
Good. Other questions? Senator Roebling.
And I'm glad Senator Bach brought up this issue with the ag land, because I have some concerns what's happened since we passed that law. Like, our county assessor has said, sent out surveys to all landowners and said, we as landowners have to reclassify our own land. We have to tell them exactly how many acres are being tilled, exactly how many are in tree stands or crep land or rim land. And the farm people are going to be taxed differently, of course, according to that. Whether or not you're in ag reserve or any of the other programs, they're trying to do it countywide. But it's a discouragement to people to put land in a tree stand or to go into crep or rim, because the lowest taxes are on the ag land. So I think that we're running into a problem with the private sector if we continue those kinds of tax policies. And they're, you know, they're really cracking down in the counties, at least in some of them.
You're talking to the right guy.
I think to that point, Senator Bach, I was listening as you were pointing this out, that in many respects, a lot of these acreages, because of having that tax provision, have been kept green and have not been coming, particularly in the metro area, to development as fast. And when you raise the issue of having these different programs, don't rule out the same structure, because it is called green acres. I mean, that's an umbrella that could mean more than just ag production, and but there might be some different criteria for those particular lands that some commitment on the part of the property owner versus like your forest management or the wildlife or whatever, and you know if it qualifies, it could qualify for the same. Make it simple, the same tax structure, but that there are certain things that are going on there that they're in fact committed to preserving. I think that's appropriate.
Good. Any other questions? Thank you, Dave. I think that was a pretty good overview of forest management practices for the DNR. I think we've raised some questions, and we wrote them down, and hopefully we'll get some answers to some of the questions we had. But I think you heard the DNR talk about the Minnesota Forest Resource Council, and over the years, this organization, with a broad spectrum of participation, has done a lot of great things for our forests. Dave Zometa, who is the executive director, he just has some ideas, some food for thought, we'll say, for potential changes in some management practices on school trust lands. And so I'm going to turn it over to him. And do we all have the piece? Mr. Zometa. Dr. Zometa.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Dave Zometa. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. You all should have a one side of a page handout that says presentation for October 29, 2008, trust fund hearing. If you don't, there are some extra copies right over here, and we could certainly get you one. How much time do I have, Senator? Do you want the five-minute version?
No, well, I think, we'd like to be done at three, but I think you get 15 minutes here, and I think this is going to be very worthwhile. So don't skim over it more than you should.
For those of you who aren't familiar with the council, just say that the Minnesota Forest Resources Council is a 17-member body, is created in response to the Sustainable Forest Resources Act that was referred to earlier, 1995. Council advises the governor, federal, state, county, and local governments on sustainable forest policies and practices. We also are responsible for developing landscape-level plans, as Mr. Shad just described, and also for site-level timber harvesting forest management guidelines. What I'm presenting to you here is a conceptual proposal regarding management of trust lands and other state lands to increase long-term income to the trust and to provide a variety of other benefits. Please don't ask me to calculate how much return to the trust this would provide in 2010. It's a conceptual proposal. I can't answer that question. Okay, by way of background, the governor's 2007 task force on competitiveness of Minnesota forest products industry called for increasing statewide timber harvest. This is a great issue, an issue of considerable concern to our primary forest products industry, a very important industry in the state. You'll recall the 2007 legislature mandated that by 2025, 25% of Minnesota's electricity come from renewable sources. And that includes woody biomass as one of those sources, and particularly important in northern Minnesota. Carbon emissions are reduced when forest industries and utilities use woody biomass rather than fossil fuel for energy. This is happening right now up on the Iron Range in Hibbing in Virginia, and various other forest industry facilities are using quite a bit of woody biomass right now. Minnesota Power in their Hibbard plant in Duluth, and so on. So there's quite a bit of this use already in place, and there's more on the drawing board, the Boys Fort Reservation, a variety of other places. Major losses associated with the largest wildfires in 90 years during 2006 and 2007, Senator Bach referred to a minute ago, highlight the need to increase woody biomass harvest to reduce fuel loads and thereby help reduce state and federal wildfire suppression costs. In 2008, in response to direction from the 2005 state legislature, The Minnesota Forest Resources Council published the first guidelines in the United States for sustainable harvest of woody biomass for energy. And I have to say, this was very farsighted on the part of the legislature, because when we were over in Finland recently with this Blandin Foundation tour, I met people in Finland that knew about our guidelines, knew about the state of Minnesota, had heard about this as cutting edge in terms of what's going on in the United States at international conferences. And it's thanks to the foresight of the legislature that we have that kind of recognition. Woody biomass harvest, when done in conjunction with sound silvicultural practices, as Mr. Epperly described, can improve long-term forest health and help restore natural ecosystems, as Mr. Shad described. Here's the proposal. To increase timber sales on trust fund and other state lands, not just the trust lands, the other state lands as well, where increased timber and woody biomass harvest would help meet management goals in subsection forest resource management plans. I think I call them state forest resource management plans. Same thing, subsection forest resource management plans. Harvest sites should include areas that, number one, are within the timber procurement zones of forest industries, number two, within the biofuel procurement zones of either forest industries or utilities that use woody biomass for energy, areas with high risk of wildfire due to high fuel loads where the woody biomass harvest would help reduce that wildfire risk, and then finally, where biomass harvest will help meet wildlife and ecological restoration goals and help restore natural ecosystems. The Division of Ecological Resources in the DNR is using $500,000 that the legislature provided in 2007 for woody biomass harvest for habitat restoration, including in scientific and natural areas. Some of you may not be aware of that, but that's actively going on. So when I'm talking about ecological restoration, I mean things that the Division of Ecological Resources is pursuing, like oak savanna restoration, that sort of thing. Harvest sites should not include areas where biomass harvest would have adverse effects on water quality, on soils, wildlife habitat, or biological diversity, as described in the guidelines that we recently produced and that are actively being used now across different ownerships, including state lands, as we ramp up training on the use of these guidelines. Now, here's what we brought back with us from Finland and Sweden, is this idea that after completing initial harvests, we should follow up with frequent forest thinnings to meet management goals in state forest resource management plans, to maintain healthy forests, and provide a steady flow of renewable energy, wood products, and income, including income to the trust. Mr. Shad showed you one example of how that might work if you were managing long-term for saw logs and older forest, but also shorter term, for aspen, for pulp and paper, and that sort of thing. It could work in either context. And we saw a lot more of this kind of silvicultural practice in Finland than we currently use here. And we're not saying that this ought to get done everywhere on every site and in the way they do it in Finland, but there are opportunities to do more of it and to see where this makes sense in terms of meeting our management goals for wildlife, for biological diversity, for timber, for energy production as well. Okay, I lay out what I perceive as the outcomes here. Is that, you know, you get some additional wood for the forest products industry, some assistance in helping meet this 25x25 renewable energy mandate, reduce losses to wildfires prospectively, and thereby reduce state and federal expenditures for wildfire suppression. We can protect the environment while we do this if we follow the woody biomass guidelines. And in addition, you know, avoid places where there's major controversy going to occur if you do this harvest. There's enough of this material on our landscape right now that we don't need to go to those real controversial places. We can do this in the places that aren't controversial, on trust lands and other lands. And perhaps most importantly to you, this would provide some additional near-term and future income, including income to the trust. And that concludes my presentation. It's a conceptual approach, but I think you see there's some win-win-win-win kinds of scenarios here for multiple interests. There's, as with any type of forest management, there are some trade-offs. You know, you can't maximize X without having some adverse effect on Y or Z. And, you know, that needs to get worked out, the details of it, through these forest resource management plans that Mr. Shad was talking about previously, where we have interdisciplinary involvement in the development of those plans in the DNR, public input from environmental groups, from forest industry, from the energy industry, citizens, whoever wants to comment. Those are very important. We have to recognize that. But I think we have some opportunities here. I wanted to lay this conceptual proposal in front of you. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Well, Dr. Zemet, it's a good proposal, I think. But as you say, it is conceptual. And, I mean, you and I have talked before. It will be expensive to do these types of thinnings. And of course, that's one hurdle that we have to get over. Whether it's through a co-op or whatever, our logging contractors can't afford to do it right now. It's just too big an investment, but it's something we can work on.
Let me respond to that. I think initially the only thing I'm proposing here is in the dot number one under proposal, increase timber sales on trust lands and other state lands where increased timber and woody biomass harvest would help meet management goals in these plans. That means increased revenue, short run. I mean, there's increased timber sales, there's increased revenue. Where you can do woody biomass sales in addition to that, that's potentially more revenue.
Yeah.
Okay? So I'm not suggesting some major outlay of state funds in the next 2 years to do this. I'm just suggesting where it's in line with existing plans, where you are developing these new plans, you consider increased levels of timber sales and increased levels of woody biomass sales in order to bring more income in. Now, that said, there's a caveat. To do the thinnings part, the last bullet under the proposal, down the line, after you do the initial harvests, if you're going to do these thinnings, that does require some investment. And that can be expensive.
Yep.
You'd want to make those investments where it makes sense, where you're not too far from markets. You know, and there's quite a lot of trust lands and other state lands that aren't all, you know, 10, 20, 30 miles around these facilities. That's the kind of places I'm thinking about, where in spite of future, fuel increases, you'd still have a viable market for this material. And the reason I'm suggesting the woody biomass harvest, you know, in conjunction with the timber harvest is that makes sense economically. You have single entry, you get this expensive equipment out there once, and ecologically, you minimize your impacts on the soils by having single entry. You don't go back in a couple years and mess up the regeneration and the habitat and so on. You want to only do it once. So,
thanks for that clarification. Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, what are the barriers to doing bullet one?
Well, there's always political opposition to anything that the DNR proposes. There are certainly some folks in the environmental community that might not like this. They'll say this is increasing timber harvest, and that has potential adverse impacts on, you know, different types of wildlife and so on and so on.
So, Mr. Chairman, is it a policy direction or authority that you don't have now? So that you would have to be given to be able to deal with it, or
no? I think the DNR's direction on this, Mr. Epperly serves on my council as a representative of the DNR, and the department's direction on this is certainly to increase, you know, timber sales. That's the direction from the commissioner. All I'm suggesting is that this be considered in future plans as they get developed in subsequent years, that this kind of approach increased timber sales in conjunction with increased woody biomass sales be considered, be factored into the department's planning and state land management. Now, recognize some of these sales are for wildlife objectives. You know, they're to improve wildlife habitat. It isn't just all for the, you know, forest products industry, or they're to provide woody biomass for renewable energy. So, there, you know, there's multiple reasons why you do this. I don't think there's any statutory authority needed to do this. That's my perspective on it.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. And I don't doubt that we have a lot of woody biomass available out there, but we have to have the demand for it with the plants that would use this as a product. And I'm wondering, have you checked how many facilities do we currently have? And if we were to build new ones or give incentives to the private sector to build new ones or the utility companies or whatever, would you think they should be located close to the source, or could we bring the woody biomass down? Like, there's a new biomass facility being built in Shakopee right now.
Right.
And, I mean, could you send it by train or something down there?
Yes.
I mean, how many would we need, and where should they be located?
We already have quite a number of these, more than you might realize. You know, District Energy, right here in St. Paul, is heating, you know, is using woody biomass for, you know, producing hot water in the pipes here, you know, in the downtown in St. Paul. So I mean, there's woody biomass facilities in, as I mentioned, in Hibbing in Virginia. They converted their coal-fired boilers to 75% woody biomass, and, you know, that's supplanting fossil fuel emissions, you know, through using woody biomass instead of coal. Right now, Minnesota Power has a substantial use of woody biomass at their Hibbert plant in Duluth. All the major forest products industries, the pulp and paper mills, for example, you know, use some amount of woody biomass, some of them a lot of woody biomass, some of it's just residual material from their processing in the plant. But there's also some coming in out of the forest. So there's a lot of these facilities.
The next
already.
Generation of woody biomass, the use of it is, you know, with biofuels. And you make, but you make a good point, Senator Roebling. You know, all the ethanol plants that are now producing the first generation of ethanol, the next generations of ethanol are coming along. A lot of it will include wood. Doesn't mean that they can't be moved down and take advantage of the ethanol plants in southern Minnesota.
Senator Saxog just mentioned the plant in Little Falls, the ethanol plant there, gets part of its heat from woody biomass right now. So this isn't just way up in the northeast part of the state. It's you know, all different parts of the state, you know, that where you have some kind of source, woody biomass. You know, some of it's, you know, tree thinnings, you know, from urban areas. Like, I live in South Minneapolis. The thinnings, when I call the tree company, they come, they take the trimmings off my trees. They come heat downtown St. Paul, you know, with District Energy. So,
well, Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, just to add to that, I think any coal plant can burn biomass, can burn wood right now in a coal plant and co-fire that. And some coal plants are doing that. So, and I just wanted to also mention, as we looked at the possibility of a new biomass plant in St. Paul this past year at the Rock 10 plant, there were a lot of studies done about what the you know, availability of biomass was, and we found that there was a shortage of supply to run it. So it's actually the market opportunity is enormous. It just has to be matched up. There's a huge demand that can be met right now, and it's growing really fast.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Zemanek, can you just speak about the effect this would have on fire suppression? You know, this is a personal issue for me because my family lost their cabin in the Ham Lake fire.
And so. I'll speak to that. The Cook County, Lake County, St. Louis County, up in the Arrowhead, just recently completed community wildfire protection plans. What I'm proposing here would be to look at where did they identify in those plans, and they're you know, 80-page plans, they're pretty robust, are the major needs for fuel load reduction. And that includes state land. There's a lot of state land up there. It's also federal land and county and private land as well. But identify where are the places where we need to reduce fuel loads on those state lands as part of this. And look at, okay, where are those areas that need fuel load reduction within some reasonable distance of a market for woody biomass for energy? Pretty easy to do with a GIS these days and geographic information system, and target your future sales to those places, you know, as new plans get developed on the state lands. Okay, now I was head of planning for the Division of Forestry for 13 years, so I'm aware of some of the problems that this kind of thing creates for the people who have to try to implement this. The existing plans are tough to change. You know, they're negotiated. There's a lot of public involvement and so on that goes on. So we've got to be careful how we do this. But I think it's an opportunity for the future. And why this is a conceptual proposal is we need to be thinking about long term. Okay. So did I answer your question,
yes,
Senator?
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions?
Senator Zuck.
Yeah.
Mr. Senator, Chair, thank
Senator
you.
Senator Scobie.
Just a... Would one of the trade-offs possibly be that we wouldn't see Minnesota wildlife in some of these areas with increased timber harvest and the thinning?
Senator, I am not proposing that we do things that adversely affect wildlife. That anything that we do needs to be done using the timber harvesting forest management guidelines that my council produces and periodically updates and are used across 95% of the, you know, the logging jobs across all ownerships in the state. And Mr. Shad, the Director of Fish and Wildlife with the DNR, showed you some of the main elements of those guidelines. They work quite well. They protect wildlife habitat. Might there be some adverse impacts relative to if you were trying to maximize wildlife values? Sure. There's always trade-offs. You know, and like I said, you know, he said you manage for one thing over here. There's winners and losers in terms of wildlife species on that particular site. But the important part of this is balance. We don't do everything the same way on all the lands. You know, so I think that's a issue that can get addressed through these planning processes, and that there's balance to be struck among the different interests. So I think that can be addressed.
Thank you.
Other questions? If not...